Our next speaker will be David Lodge. He's with the, Center for a Sustainable Future, Cornell University, and he will be speaking about the Great Lakes. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be talking about this issue, an issue that I've been devoting much of my research attention to for the last 25 or more years. And also I'm delighted to be singing the tune of We Can Do This, because that's a tune I've been happy to sing for some time as well, as it's become clear that we've had very rapid advances in science and technology that can be used to great effect in fighting invasive species, as previous speakers have emphasized. My assigned role today is to talk about the Great Lakes, to shine a spotlight on the Laurentian or North American Great Lakes as a case study of both the problem, the magnitude of impacts, and the possibilities and indeed the beginnings of success in combating invasive species. But if you will, I want to introduce this topic not with an example from the Great Lakes, but with an example from my own family, sort of deep personal history. The guy in the middle of this top photograph is my great-great-grandfather on his farm near Auburn, Alabama in the late 1930s. And he gathered these people from the farm and the community around him to help him celebrate the successful introduction on the farm of this plant in the foreground. Now, you may recognize this plant more from the bottom photograph, at least those of you familiar with the southeastern United States or increasingly other parts of the country, as I'll illustrate in a moment. My great-great-grandfather introduced kudzu for at least two good reasons: to control soil erosion and to replenish nitrogen in the soils after decades of row cropping. So there were good reasons to introduce kudzu. There were benefits. The problem, of course, that we can recognize in hindsight is that over time, the harms from the introduction of kudzu have far outweighed the benefits. Now, if you look at the top here in the timeline, and I'm afraid I don't know what's happened to the map in the background, but you can see that there's a map of the United States there. And what you're watching is the spread of kudzu over time. And so this problem is not limited to the farm in Alabama, where I still have two uncles who have spent a great deal of time, energy, and resources during their lifetimes fighting kudzu on the farm. The problem is now spread nationwide, increasingly with climate change, and now getting more severe because kudzu's been joined by another species from Asia, from whence kudzu came, the kudzu bug, which does eat kudzu, but more problematically eats a close relative of kudzu, which is soybean. And in the areas of the epicenter of the invasion of the kudzu bug in Georgia, we've seen declines in soybean yields of as much as 20%. So in general, this is one of hundreds of illustrations, and you've already seen a few others from other ecosystems this morning, where small beginnings, in this case, intentional introductions of a plant, unintentional introductions of a bug, can lead to huge impacts. And a major point I want to leave you with is that these impacts have not reached culmination. These impacts, as the map of still spreading kudzu illustrate, they grow in spatial scale and an absolute magnitude over time. So with that as a general introduction, with characteristics that are applied to introductions of invasive species in many ecosystems, I do want to turn to the Great Lakes. And here I've put the introductions of non-indigenous species over time in the context of three of the best studied aquatic ecosystems on the planet. And what you can see is that in all of them, we see an increasing introduction of species, an accumulation of non-indigenous species. And in the Great Lakes, we have now on the order of almost 200 species. Now, I think future speakers, Greg Ruiz perhaps, may address that in fact, we're seeing some signs of success in the Great Lakes, that the introductions are slowing, but you can see the general overall pattern here that still applies to many ecosystems. And in the Great Lakes, about 70% of these species have been delivered over time by ships, and in a recent study by my colleagues and me, we documented that since the opening of the Great Lakes and since the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway, we see that on an annual basis, the cost of species that have over time been delivered to the Great Lakes is somewhere in the $100 to $800 million annually in just the Great Lakes, actually just on the U.S. side of the Great Lakes. And I'm sure this range is actually probably an underestimate. So even for one ecosystem, the North American Great Lakes, for a part of it that we had data adequate to study, we see very large financial impacts and loss of fisheries and ecosystem services. So with that as an overview of the Great Lakes, I want to now give you a couple of examples, and a couple of examples that many of you may in fact be familiar with, but I want to make a couple of important points with them. I want to start with dry-seated mussels, zebra mussels and quagga mussels, two closely related species, introduced originally by ships, discovered first in about 1986, caused tremendous loss of ecosystem services and other kinds of financial damages. You can't go to the beach if you can't walk on a beach because your feet are going to get cut up by zebra mussel shells. Power plants have been shut down and have to spend millions of dollars every year to keep their pipes clean. Buoys get weighed down. Ships' propellers get clogged up. All kinds of problems with infrastructure and other ecosystem services, including the disruption of fisheries. Well, this too is an invasion like kudzu that is, in fact, still going on. Species spread rapidly within the Great Lakes, but then used the canal, the artificial canal in the Chicago, connecting the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River to shoot down the Mississippi River, then started going across country on boats and trailers that that humans take out here in the sunny west in the winter. In 2007, we published a paper highlighting Lake Mead as a likely first landing spot for dry-scented mussels in the west, and indeed in the same year they were discovered in Lake Mead. And from Lake Mead, of course, Lake Mead then acted as sort of a super spreader, a site of propagules to spread throughout the western water infrastructure, like the canal here from the Colorado River. And now the leaders of British Columbia and Alberta and Washington, Idaho, and Oregon are spending a great deal of political will and financial resources to prevent these species from invading the Columbia River, where there's a great deal more water infrastructure and other ecosystem services to be lost. So like kudzu, although we're familiar with this invasion, and we may think we know all about it already, it's still going on. So within the absence of management, these are the patterns that we see. And the same is true for another example I want to provide you. Asian carps, two species in this case, big-headed carp and silver carp, introduced in this case intentionally in about 1974 to control nuisance algae and nuisance mollusks in aquaculture. A few other intentional spreading events, but for the most part, natural dispersal and propagation and reproduction is leading to the spread that you see here. Both these species are spreading northward, and indeed, when my group got involved in studying these two species in 2009, at the request of federal agencies, we discovered that, in fact, they posed a much more imminent threat to invading the Great Lakes than had previously been appreciated. So species introduced for good reasons, but in the end, the harms dramatically outweigh the benefits. I'll come back to this example in a few minutes. So now I want to zoom out from the Great Lakes and think about, just in aggregate, how big of a problem are we talking about? So when we consider not just terrestrial ecosystems and freshwater, but also marine ecosystems, I've just accumulated here a few of the most recent national or regional estimates done by collaborative groups of people, including economists, that estimate the aggregate damages, and I've expressed all of these in terms of 2015 equivalent U.S. billions of dollars. So you can see that, and all of these they include some quite crude methods, but they're probably all, I would suggest, underestimates. And so for the U.S., for example, in 2015 dollars, we now have an unofficial tax on U.S. households. It's approximately $1,200 per household. Or to put it another way, these are negative economic externalities that have not been internalized in any way. Or to put it another way, these are subsidies by the public to the industries that or individuals that benefit from the introduction, either intentional or unintentional, from these species. And you can see that everywhere these kinds of studies are being carried out, we come up with non-trivial numbers relative to the size of the economies in those places. So the challenge, as I've already illustrated with those animated maps, is that in the absence of management, we see often exponential increases of spatial coverage and therefore exponential increases in the loss of ecosystem services and other financial damages as the species reproduce and spread, whether under their own steam or through subsequent introduction by people. And this has led to the impression, as Jamie and other speakers have already emphasized, that these are apparently irreversible. And so our standard policy approach has been not to internalize these external costs in any way, but rather simply for us humans to suffer from those introductions, to react to them by adapting our behavior rather than managing the other species. We simply change our behavior. And what I want to suggest is that while this approach, this policy approach may have been necessary, if you will, for the generation of my great-great-grandfather, we know a lot more. We have learned a lot, especially in the last 20 or 30 years, that could inform quite a different approach, as previous speakers have already suggested, and as I want to emphasize here. So you can't see it down here, but I'm emphasizing that, again, innovations, recent innovations, and that I want to go on to highlight now, in science and technology could be facilitated by innovative policy, either public or private policy, so that we could reverse this tide and, in fact, increase the net economic benefits of the trade in shipping and air travel, for example, that Earl just illustrated. We can increase the net economic benefits of our global trade by more carefully and strategically using science and technology to prevent harmful introductions in the future. We do this all the time in other contexts. So we wouldn't think of taking that kind of simply accept the consequences and change our own behavior if when we're talking about pharmaceutical safety or food safety or infectious disease. Instead, for these kinds of arenas, we expect, and indeed we have delivered to us by agencies and other organizations, risk-based management to get the benefits of global trade and health improvements and food without the harms, or at least by minimizing the harms. So I want to now provide one more example of an invasive species that I hope will illustrate the hopeful message that, in fact, we do have the knowledge to take quite a different approach. And this is the example of a viral invasive species, a virus that infects humans, the SARS virus, and the invasion, the global invasion by the SARS virus in humans in 2003. And you can watch the timeline, and you can watch the global map, and you can watch the steps as they come up that were taken to make this a dramatically different story than the stories of kudzu and dry sinned mussels and Asian carps. This is a story that doesn't last very long. It lasts less than a year, if you watch this timeline down here, and it results not in exponentially increasing infection rates and damages and loss of human health, but rather what you will see illustrated is the stopping the spread of the invasion of the SARS virus, and then a rolling back of the invasion in countries that were infected, and finally, again, in less than a year, an eradication of this organism, an organism that we did not even know the identity of when the global invasion started. But we had an appropriate and effective apparatus, nationally and internationally, to manage this invasion. Now, the invasion did end up, of course, with dramatic costs on the order of 800 human deaths and about 10 times that humans infected, but also billions of dollars of lost travel, trade, and commerce because of the effective management of this one species. So, very different outcome with the application of some old, but also some innovative new approaches to management. We can quickly eradicate invasions. So I want to now finish the last segment of my talk by giving a little more specific illustration of some of these more recently innovative approaches that are being applied and could much more readily be applied to invasive species more generally if we had adequate investments in research, development, and application. And so I'm going to step through these sort of stages of invasion and how we can respond to that. And I first want to illustrate, if you want more details, I would encourage you to consult an article that's just out, a review, a quite wide-ranging review of the topics I'm talking about in the Annual Review of Environment and Resources that will provide all the references and everything else in the background to what I'm talking about today. So I want to first give you very quickly examples of new approaches to these steps. The first one, for lots of intentionally introduced organisms, and the examples that I've given you already for intentionally induced organisms include kudzu and the Asian carps. So we have many new tools that have been developed by my group and many other groups across the world for all kinds of organisms in lots of different ecosystems that are basically species profiling, but they use increasingly sophisticated statistical and machine learning tools to accurately discriminate between species that are proposed for introduction that will be harmful from species that could be released in an environment, in this case the Laurentian Great Lakes, probably without great harm. And these tools are being gradually taken up more effectively by, for example, the USDA and the Fish and Wildlife Service has certainly been investing in these tools, but we could make much more rapid progress in these kinds of species profiling tools to, again, gain the benefits of the trade in organisms, but minimize the harmful effects by keeping out the species that are most likely to be harmful. Now, another major challenge, as previous speakers have alluded to, is that we can't manage a species. We can't eradicate or control or manage in any way a species if we don't know where it is. And that's been a huge problem for many kinds of organisms. How do we know where it is with sufficient warning to make eradication possible in a cost-effective way? So my group pioneered in the first sort of large geographic scale application of environmental DNA on an organism of management concern, the Asian carps that I talked about earlier, and that's how we discovered that these species were actually much closer to the Great Lakes than had previously been appreciated. So these kinds of new eDNA surveillance and monitoring tools, in addition to the quite different kinds of genetic technologies that previous speakers have mentioned, the gene editing and gene drive technologies, hold great promise both for increasingly accurate and cheaper and quicker surveillance, and also offer potentially quite exciting mechanisms to actually do the control and eradication. But I want to, without indicating any particular methods, also just make sure that we understand together that there are an increasing, rapidly increasing number of highly effective eradication programs for a wide range of kinds of species in a wide range of ecosystems and settings. So we are doing this, and we could do more of it with more strategic investments in innovation. Also, when we can't eradicate with the current toolbox, when we can't effectively control prevention, as Earl Campbell just said, that's where the biggest bang for the buck will always remain. And it can be done at a variety of spatial scales. Our work and the work of others has informed more priority risk assessment driven decisions about where and what kinds of interventions can slow the spread among inland lakes in the Great Lakes region and among the Great Lakes themselves. I'm sure Greg Ruiz is going to talk more about ballast water, so I won't say much about that. But our work with eDNA and the Asian carps drove increasingly effective investments, we hope anyway, in improved and more numerous electric barriers to protect the Great Lakes from Asian carps and other organisms. And with the last example I want to leave you with, the Great Lakes provide one of the most powerful, successfully implemented control strategies that had a very systematic strategic R&D program behind it, and with a $20 million investment annually since 1955 by Canada and the U.S., successfully control the sea lamprey. That's a lot of money, but it's a great investment because without it, we'd lose much more than a $20 million fishery, and other ecosystem services values in the Great Lakes. And of course, in agriculture, we've been doing this for generations. I'm not, with this photograph, advocating aerial spraying indiscriminately of all sorts of new chemicals, but what I am suggesting is when we have appropriate investments in R&D, we can develop strategies that can have widespread accomplishment of improved control and eradication and prevention of invasive species. We do not have to live in the situation now that my great-great-grandfather was in, where we couldn't possibly anticipate or manage the consequences. We're in quite a different world, where all those damages should represent economic opportunities for investment and improvements. Thank you very much.